Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome, America. Have you ventured out into the blogosphere? It's filled right now with over 4 million different blogs, weblogs, electronic diaries, and post-it boards up on the internet that are available to all, and this poses an information revolution that is very difficult to exaggerate. It is so powerful that it has upended corporations, institutions, and completely changed the way information is transferred, catapulted, disseminated, and analyzed in America today. You want witnesses? Just ask Trent Lott, Howell Raines, Dan Rather, and Eason Jordan. We're going to be talking about what all this means. Dan Rather and Eason Jordan were two of America's most prominent news media personalities and executives. Dan Rather was toppled after the document gate, memo gate scandal that the bloggers broke. Eason Jordan was toppled just over the weekend from his post as the chief news executive for CNN when bloggers went after comments he made at the World Economic Forum at Davos, Switzerland, arguing that American troops had targeted journalists to be exterminated, to be killed in Iraq. The blogosphere has changed everything. Power is now no longer in the hands of a very isolated media elite, so much it is now being distributed throughout America to people who have access to a keyboard and a computer and the internet and have changed the face of journalism. One man, I think, knows more about blogging than any other, and he's going to be on the program today. It's Hugh Hewitt, my dear friend, and also a Salem talk show host. He is also one of America's most influential bloggers at HughHewitt.com, and we're going to have him as our guest in the second segment. It's going to be a discussion you won't want to miss, and we'll get to that in just a few moments. We've been tracking the issue of Charles and Camilla, not for the soap opera value of this, but getting back to the basic Christian question of whether adultery means anything anymore, because in this case, we have two people who've been cohabitating, living in sin, who've been involved in an extramarital relationship and living together in open adultery for a number of years, and now they are to get married on April the 8th in a civil ceremony that is to receive thereafter the blessing of the Church of England. It just so happens that that church's General Synod is being held right now. It's an awkward time for the prince. But Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams led the Synod in a prayer, praying for God's guidance for the couple, referring to them as those who are trying to live in, quote, the glare of publicity at this time. The Archbishop seems unconcerned about the adultery issue, but there are evangelicals in the Church of England who decided to make it an issue. They tried to get it on the agenda for the Synod, but they were turned back. And as a matter of fact, the General Synod said it is not going to deal with this. One spokesman said for the Church of England, this would be a matter of public interest, but it would not be a discussion in the public interest. Now, I just want to lament publicly what this means, that a church is unwilling actually to deal with the issue of adultery. But I'm going to have to let the Church of England speak for itself on that matter. And if the Church of England blesses this wedding, it will be speaking very loudly. We're all going to know what it means. Walmart's joined the bandwagon. You may be surprised about this, but Walmart has now disclosed in a statement of ethics filed with the Securities and Exchange Commission that it is now going to recognize as family members for the purpose of benefits immediate family members who will include, whether by birth, adoption, marriage, or domestic partnership or civil union, if recognized by your state or local law, spouse, children, parents, siblings, mothers and fathers-in-law, sons and daughters-in-law, and brothers and sisters-in-law, period. Did you follow that? The key issues you should have heard were the inclusion of persons who are related by domestic partnership or civil union. A Walmart spokesman told CNN that the revised policy would apply to same-sex couples, quote, in geographical areas where those relationships are officially recognized, end quote. Of course, Walmart is the nation's private employer, 1.2 million workers, and it has worked hard to uphold its image as a family store, but this particular move is likely to get Walmart some unexpected and perhaps unwelcome publicity because its definition of family is now very much at odds with where most Americans are in understanding what family means. I received a fascinating email from Paducah. Dan Tankersley sent this to me. It is a letter to the editor written by a 15-year-old girl. Listen to this letter that she wrote to the local paper there in Paducah, Kentucky. She said this, I'm a 15-year-old female with some questions. As part of my desire to become a great unbiased journalist, I would like to know the answers I can't seem to find anywhere else. Regarding the Scott Peterson trial, Scott was found guilty of the first-degree murder of his wife, Lacey, and second-degree murder of Connor, his unborn son. Throughout the entire investigation and trial, the unborn baby was referred to either as Connor or the baby. My first question is, why was Scott, the father of baby Connor, found guilty of killing his unborn son when Lacey, the mother, could have had an abortion at any time during the pregnancy? Then there would have been no trial, even though it would have been the same outcome as what Scott did to Connor. Under these circumstances, Connor would never have been called Connor. He would have been called the fetus, and Lacey, or the doctor, would not have been called killing him. They would have been terminating the pregnancy. I understand that some think Lacey or any mother could enter pregnancy any time she wants to because it's, quote, her, end quote, body and her baby. But is Connor not just as much Scott's as he is Lacey's? Should the father not have as much right to his unborn son as the mother? Why are there legal consequences of premeditated murder for an unborn baby, yet there aren't any for premeditated abortion? My next question is, when did Connor become a baby and not a fetus? I do understand that in order for Scott to kill Connor, he would have had to kill Lacey also. We know that Scott was guilty of murdering baby Connor, which means that Connor had rights as a human being. Why don't unborn babies to be aborted have rights? Amazing letter, I think, written by a 15-year-old girl there in the Paducah newspaper. Sophie McDonald is her name. God bless you, Sophie. There's an awful lot of common sense and moral conviction in that letter. And it's a reminder to us that we're living in such confusing times in which Scott Peterson can rightly, I would argue, be convicted of murder in the case of Connor as well as in the case of Connor's mother, Lacey, Scott Peterson's wife. But that same argument that this dear young lady is making would prevail in California, even now, and all across America, where abortion is legal. If Lacey had gone in to get an abortion, we wouldn't be having this conversation, but Connor would be just as dead. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, senator from Tennessee, now says he has enough votes to go nuclear. He's not talking about nuclear weapons. He's talking about something very powerful, however. He's talking about changing the rules of the Senate so as to prevent the use of a filibuster against judicial nominees sent by the President of the United States. Now, whether or not Frist has the 51 votes he needs to change the rules will be evident only when this issue gets to a vote. But this is at least a salvo sent by the Senate's majority leader to the Democratic opposition that he is not going to put up with a filibuster. But I think this is going to be tested. I think it's one thing for Senator Frist to claim this. It will be another thing for the senator to have this before him as a changed rule in the Senate. So long as a minority in the Senate can use the filibuster to block judicial nominees from facing a vote in the Senate, then we're going to see the president's nominees stymied. And we're going to see the Senate come up short in its constitutional obligation to fulfill its responsibility to review and then to vote up or down the president's nominees for judicial appointment. Now, it just so happens that President Bush has now renominated 12 candidates who were blocked in his first term, and so Senator Frist and the rest of the Senate are about to get their test as to whether or not they're going to be serious about fulfilling this responsibility. We've talked a great deal about Ake Green, the Pentecostal pastor in Sweden who was convicted for hate speech for preaching against homosexuality. Now his conviction has been overturned by superior legal authorities in Sweden. The Reverend Ralph Turner, a priest from the Swedish branch of the British-based Holy Catholic Church, said, quote, "This indicates that the justice system works and that it gives a certain amount of protection to us who preach God's word. There are those on the other side who see this as a failure of nerve on the part of the Swedish government and the Swedish legal system to follow through with the logical consequences of that nation's very liberal hate speech law." It's going to be interesting to see how this comes down. Either this is an isolated case in which the reversal of this conviction is just an eccentric one-off, it's not going to be repeated again, or you see a nation here that really can't face the consequences of the very law that it passed. This kind of insidious hate speech law was directly written so as to prevent preachers from being able to speak or preach or teach against homosexuality. As a matter of fact, the prosecutor in this case said, as we recorded on the air just last week, there are some things preachers just can't say. That's what he said. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a complete and utter denial of religious liberty. What in the world are we going to do when we look across this country and see the kind of moral confusion? Well, we should be challenged to bring moral clarity. That's our responsibility. But we are living in confusing times, and every once in a while, it's just good to get a piece of good news. Such news came out of Sri Lanka. were baby Abilas, a four-month-old boy dubbed Baby 81, who was found in the debris of the tsunami, is now being reunited with his parents. This little boy was born on October 19. That's my birthday. I have a special, special feeling for this little kid. He was separated by his parents, found in the debris, rescued. Several different parents claimed him, but DNA tests were administered, and his parents were revealed. His parents said this, "We are so happy. We only have to thank God for giving our child back. We got the results for all of our hardships." Well, there was so much heartache. There was so much death and destruction in the aftermath of that tsunami. The entire world needs to take notice when this little baby boy is reunited with his grateful parents. We'll be back to talk about the revolution of the blogosphere with Hugh Hewitt as guest. I'm Albert Moeller. He's a law professor, political analyst, talk show host on Salem Network, and also one of America's most influential bloggers. Now he is our guide to the entire blogosphere. Hugh Hewitt's our guest today, the author of Blog Understanding the Information Reformation. He's also a good friend. Hugh, we're thankful you came on the program today.
Dr. Moeller, great to be here. Thanks for having me, and thanks for your kind words about blog.
Well, listen, I think it is the indispensable guide for understanding what in the world's happening in this information revolution. Of course, you call it a reformation. I like that. We're going to get to that in just a minute, but first of all, we better tell some people what a blog is and, frankly, why they matter.
Sure. A weblog is an individual site run by one, two, most three or four people on which they post their views and news of the day, and they link to those sources. They are sort of cyber newspapers run as in the old days of the early republic by a handful of people, but using the Internet to publish. In 1999, there were two dozen of them. Today, there are more than 7 million of them. And some estimates have it at 40,000 new blogs being created every single day.
Well, Hugh, who in the world's reading these things?
Well, the traffic is enormous. 27% of online users, 27% of the people who use the Internet in January, also consulted one or more blogs. Now, some blogs are huge, like Glenn Reynolds' Instapundit, which gets more than 250,000 people many days, and others get 5, 6, 1, 2, 3 people. But they all get some traffic, and they all exist, and they all influence opinion, and collectively it's dynamic.
Well, the dynamic you really indicate here is the fact that the whole news business, the way we convey and analyze information, has now been democratized. I mean, frankly, you have a new democracy of information because, as you're arguing, the mainstream media have kind of lost control of the ability to contain and bury stories.
They have. The gatekeepers have no more gates, and we no longer have to persuade someone to be able to persuade someone. I know the frustration I used to have when I'd send in an op-ed to the L.A. Times or another big newspaper and get it back saying, thank you, no thank you, it doesn't fit our pages. Well, now all I have to do is go over to HughHewitt.com and write what I want, and if I have an audience and I get 30,000 to 40,000 people a day coming there, they'll come and listen and read and think and accept or reject based upon what I have to offer and the arguments I craft, not whether or not some opinion page editor thinks it's worthy of their attention.
Well, let's get down to the fact that the blogs have actually changed the way the news, the mainstream media, have to deal with the news. I mean, after all, it was the bloggers who forced the story about Trent Lott, the story about Howell Raines, the New York Times, the story about Dan Rather and Rathergate, and now, just over the weekend, Eason Jordan and CNN. And, Hugh, I think you had a hand in that.
Well, we did. I'm very pleased with the fact I did. There were a number of bloggers involved, though, including the Powerline blog, Instapundit. Michelle Malkin did a tremendous amount of work on this. Ed Morrissey of Captain's Quarters. And it all goes down to the fact that when Eason Jordan went to Davos, Switzerland on January 27th and accused the military of targeting journalists, he was repeating an accusation he had made in November of last year in which he said 8 to 10 journalists had been killed by the American military and that the American military was torturing journalists. Mainstream media did not care about this, but there was a blogger in Davos, Ronnie Abovitz, who posted an account of it, and that account made it to National Review's Jim Garrity, and then I picked up on it, broadcast about it. And by the a week ago, I was able to go on Chris Matthews' show and announce to their surprise that Eason Jordan was in trouble. They'd never heard of it. And yet, within another week, Eason Jordan was obliged to quit because information travels fast, and true information has a devastating impact when people slander the American military. He did. He resigned as a result, and the blogosphere actually ended up beginning and ending a story even before some papers like the Los Angeles Times had even mentioned it, Al.
Yeah, but you really forced the issue. That's what I appreciate. And let's go back to Rathergate for just a few moments. In your book, which really reads like a thriller in some sections, because you recount how these events came to pass and how bloggers really got on a story and forced the mainstream media to pay attention, Dan Rather's indefensible act in putting forth, and let's broaden this to CBS as a network, their indefensible act in putting forth these obviously fraudulent memos was really brought to light when bloggers started saying, hey, that looks like modern word processing technology, and basically forced the mainstream media to take a look at it.
That's right. It began on the Free Republic with one poster who said, that looks like a forgery to me. Then the Powerline bloggers, who are three very successful lawyers, very well-trained, all went to Dartmouth, two went to Harvard Law School, one went to Stanford Law School. They combined to begin to elicit from their audience, which is vast. They get 100,000 people coming there every day. What do you think, and does anyone have any professional opinions to provide us? And there are lots of experts on everything out there, as we all are expert in something. And they came forward with the information that quickly developed into a conclusive case that they had been forged. Then it spread from places like Little Green Footballs. Many of the bloggers have very funny names, but very serious agendas and very focused approaches and very skilled abilities when it comes to investigation. Rather, never repudiated the documents, but the rest of the world did. And before long, it was obvious they had been forged. It was obvious it was a hit piece on George W. Bush, and it failed. I think it probably helped him secure the presidential reelection that was his in November.
Yeah, one of the arguments being made by some who observe the blogosphere is that it helps conservatives because the conservative sites help to distribute the information conservatives need, and the liberal sites tend to accidentally do the same thing.
Well, I think that all of new media, because old media was so dominated by the left, whenever there's anything that is dominated by one power, if equality and access or any kind of change occurs, it's got to help the minority power, the faction. Since elite media is so far to the left, Alan, you know this.
Absolutely.
Any kind of opening for truth, any kind of opening for balance, inevitably helps the center-right in this country far more than it helps the center-left. But I am curious if you think the analogy to Reformation makes sense, because your church history command is so absolute. I'm a little bit nervous asking that question, but I'll be curious to hear what you say.
No, listen, that's right where I was headed with my next question, because I found it fascinating that you used the word Reformation, and I really appreciate the way that you demonstrate that Johannes Gutenberg's invention of the movable type is providentially what allowed the writings of Martin Luther to be distributed all over Europe with the Catholic gatekeepers unable to prevent it. And that, I think, is the best metaphor I could think of for the emergence of the blog.
That's what struck me as being so persuasive. The Vatican and the Pope in the early 1500s are sitting there unaware that on their watch has developed a new technology and a new voice that would proliferate quickly, not just dissenting opinion, but also a text of Scripture in German that would allow people to decide for themselves what they meant by any particular passage, and which would allow the rapid dissemination of that new text. They were stunned that their monopoly had been shattered. They reacted by attempting to suppress it. Then they attempted to bargain with it. And then eventually they were just, the Counter-Reformation came along, and that wasn't bad for everyone concerned.
Well, when you use the word Reformation, you raise a host of issues, and I appreciate the fact that you not only date the Reformation and point the mass communications aspect of it, but you actually get down to what the Reformation was about. So as your theologian friend, I want to say thank you.
Well, I hope the history is good. I had some help. I went and found some good theologian, good church historians to make sure I didn't miss anything. But it's a sketchy, quick couple of
it's
chapters
good stuff
in there. But nevertheless, the argument holds true that the old media, the big three networks, the big newspapers, were very much like the Vatican when the Vatican was challenged by Luther. They are reacting even today as the Vatican reacted to Luther then. Slow, unsure of themselves, very, very dyspeptic, and very, very threatened.
Well, that's the first time I think the word dyspeptic has been used on this program in a long time. But that's one of the things I appreciate about Hugh Hewitt, a very learned and articulate man who, frankly, is preparing right now for his own nationally broadcast radio program on the Salem Radio Networks coming up at 6 o'clock. So when we finish here, you need to go right over there, and then you need to go buy Blog. Published by Nelson Publishers, it is the indispensable guide to the Internet Revolution, the Information Reformation, and the blogosphere. Hugh, thank you so much for giving us some time this afternoon.
Thank you, Al. Always a pleasure.
Well, folks, we're going to be talking about what the blogosphere means to you. I want to tell you, just as a Christian theologian, I think one of the things that it means to me is that that information is now immediately and almost universally accessible to anyone who can get to the computer. That's an amazing thing, just with the Great Commission in mind. I want to know about your adventures in the blogosphere. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. From the radio sphere about the blogosphere, I'm Albert Moeller.
Listening to the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmoeller.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Moeller.
Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. The topic today is the blogosphere. It was great to have my friend Hugh Hewitt as our guest in the second segment. He's my colleague on the editorial board for Salem Broadcasting, and he really is about the best guide to the blogosphere that I know. He was one of the first to really jump on it, and of course you've seen his name associated with some of the big news stories related to the blogosphere, from Dan Rather to Eason Jordan, CNN, and all the rest. But, you know, a lot of the blogs don't get that kind of media attention, but they still have a lot of influence and impact. Some of the names, Instapundit, Powerline, The Daily Kos, by the way, that's one from the far left, they're joined by explicitly Christian weblogs, such as a very fine daily updated weblog at ChristianityToday.com, where you'll find just all kinds of news of interest to the Christian community. And I give a lot of my time, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, to a major essay published in a weblog format at crosswalk.com, also found at Albert Moeller, MOHLER.com. And I should say Truth in Advertising as a way of disclosure here, that Hugh Hewitt was very nice to mention my columns in his book a few times, and that was nice too. But I want to know where you go in the blogosphere. What have you found to be helpful, interesting? Why? Where do you go? And what do you find there? The phone number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. You know, as Christians looking at this, we should see an opportunity, an incredible opportunity. First, there were none. Then were about a dozen in 1999, 4 million last year, and already this year, 7 million blogs out there. As Hugh said, maybe 40,000 new blogs a day. There's an opportunity for a lot of Christian confrontation in there, for a lot of Christian worldview teaching. There's an opportunity to get a lot out. You know, one of the things that Hugh was talking about is how the mainstream media has had to take account of the blogs. But you know what? So are the rulers of nations like China and Cuba, who would like to keep the Christian gospel out. Because the internet is this giant way of conveying information. It's not only a superhighway, it's like an ocean. And anyone that can tap right into that ocean has access to an enormous world and wealth of information. And, of course, this means that the powers that be simply don't have the power they once had. You know, years ago, you could talk about the media giants, you could talk about the three networks, and then you could see the explosion into cable news and all those variants. Just a few years ago, there were daily newspapers that basically had control over everything just in locales, cities, communities, villages. But now you have USA Today, a national newspaper. Beyond that, you have the ability of anyone, any place through the internet to read almost any paper at any time. And this changes everything. It has changed world politics, and it will change the way we address the world as Christians as well, because it gives us an enormous tool in order that we could reach people. Give me a call, 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Where do you go in the blogosphere? What do you read? What would you recommend that other intelligent Christians should take a look at? You need to share that, because this is where the traffic is moving in the information superhighway. This is where an awful lot of what's happening is first becoming apparent. I mean, after all, the blogs are almost instantly updatable. A news story can all of a sudden emerge, and I love Hugh's expression, a blog swarm. That's what happens when all of a sudden bloggers begin to talk about one issue. It happened with Dan Rather. Everyone started looking at the document. It did look like it came off a word processor. And then someone came up with the fact that no such technology existed in 1972. It would be impossible. And they started tracking this thing down, and then they began connecting the dots. And before you knew it, Dan Rather was, well, they called it retiring from CBS. But in reality, his journalistic credibility was in tatters. Eason Jordan had to resign just last Friday as the news chief of CNN because he was caught in comments he made at Davos, Switzerland. And as Hugh said, it wasn't just that he'd made those comments. It's that bloggers were able to substantiate and prove he had made similar comments months previous. So it wasn't like he misspoke. He was making a serious argument all over again. This whole world of the internet weblog, or the blogosphere, as it is now known, is changing the field of politics. There are those who are arguing that Howard Dean's election as chairman of the Democratic National Committee is entirely due to the fact that the bloggers from the left went after all of his competitors, leaving the former Vermont governor as the only candidate for the leadership of that very crucial political party. It'll be interesting to see what that means. But from the left, it is clear that the bloggers on the liberal side are able to knock off those who they think are just insufficiently liberal. And, of course, there are a lot of conservative watchdogs out there as well. You know, the interesting thing about blogs is that they don't disappear. They just get archived on the Internet. You can go back and find something, prove what someone said, find what someone wrote. It's a completely new world. What's your place in it? Where do you go? What have you found? The number 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about the blogosphere, this information revolution that is literally changing the way news is disseminated, analyzed, communicated, and then catapulted into the national arena. Because what is now happening is that the bloggers can swarm around an issue, and within 24 hours, you're hearing about it on cable television, you're reading about it in the newspapers, no one can deny it, no one can avoid it, they simply have to face it, and the mainstream media have discovered there is a new set of rules. And that's altogether good for those of us who love the truth and believe in an exchange of ideas and getting the truth out. I want to know what you think about the blogosphere, where you go, what you see, what you read, and what you would recommend. Give me a call, 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to go to Aaron, listening on WFIA Radio. Aaron, welcome.
Good evening, Dr. Mohler. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great. Glad to hear from you.
Hey, I called because you were asking what Christian-based blogs people go to out there. I myself am a blogger here in Louisville and list a number of them on my site, but probably one of the most frequently attended sites that I go to is markdroberts.com.
Yeah, pastor of the Irvine Presbyterian Church in California. We've been actually in the media together at times. Mark's a very, very faithful pastor and an ardent blogger.
Exactly. And I remember when you and Pastor Roberts actually, we're on the Hugh Hewitt Show together talking about the mainstream media's approach to Christianity during the Christmas season.
Yeah, that's right. And since then, I have been pretty familiar with Mark's site. And by the way, that's markdroberts. Is it com or org?
I believe it's .com.
All right. But we're going to put up a set of links after this program so that you can find some of these places. Aaron, how long have you been blogging?
I've been blogging for about 6 months now, and was really surprised at how quickly my site grew in readership, and that was primarily because it was recognized by Hugh Hewitt. He started doing a blog of the month section on his site, and for whatever reason, he found my site and put it up there last October, and I've just been having all kinds of traffic since.
Well, I bet. But, Aaron, tell us how we can find your weblog.
Mine is gotdesign, that's gotdesign .blogspot.com.
Well, we appreciate you giving us a call today, Aaron. I'm going to put that up. Let me ask you, would you recommend to fellow believers that they ought to, first of all, check out the blogs, and secondly, would you recommend that they ought to consider blogging themselves?
Oh, definitely. This is a wonderful way to put out your Christian witness. It's also a good way to develop what I would call a virtual community of fellow believers that you can go out and, see what other believers are saying on the web. And, if you agree or disagree, you can post comments to that effect. And, you can start very intellectually stimulating conversations about your beliefs on the web.
Aaron, thanks so much for your call, and we'll be glad to refer people to your weblog as well and put up a link, and we wouldn't have known about it had you not called here and had not Hugh Hewitt given it some attention. You know, folks, we are really, really witnessing a revolution here. Let me tell you, when I came to Southern Seminary's president in 1993, we did not have a web page. We did not have an internet website, and no one even knew what one was. I can remember the first time I heard about a home page. And that was before almost anyone had one or had gone to one. And we've tried to stay on the forefront of this information revolution. The internet is now more or less the most important way a lot of people get to meet us, get to exchange information. Just think of what this does. This brings information right to your computer screen. Of course, there are bad things that come along with that. That's why we've talked about internet pornography and chat rooms and all the rest. But don't discount the good things that have come by the internet, and especially now with weblogs. I read weblogs on the other side, too. That is, I look at sites like the Daily Kos and others because I want to find out what the liberals are talking about. I want to find out what anti-Christian weblogs are talking about. I want to know what's going on out there in the world, and the weblogs are a shorthand. I guess that may be the best way to look at it. They're a shorthand. You can quickly find out what's going on. You can read little summaries, and if you want to read the whole article with the links, you can go right there. The next thing you know, you've already been given a distilled summary. Now you can read the heart of the entire article if that's what you're looking for. I love what's happening with making information more democratically accessible. I like that, first of all, as a Christian, because this means that the gatekeepers that would, for the secular world, just want to keep Christianity out, they're going to be unable to do that, because all you have to do is do a quick Google search, go on the web, all you have to do is look left or right, up or down, and you're going to find yourself confronted with somebody who's going to be making a serious Christian argument out there. That's one of the as many bad things as there are on the internet. Let's be thankful for how much is out there. Do you realize that right now there are 35 different translations of the Bible accessible just on one site? That's an incredible thing. People from many different languages can go, even if they can't buy a Bible, or they can't get their hands on a Bible. They may not be able to get to a library, which will be forbidden even to have a Bible. But if they can get to an internet, you just can't block all these sites. You know, that's one of the realities with spam, by the way, those unwanted notices you get in your email box, and they irritate all of us, and I'm thankful it's been made a crime. I just hope there's some people that sit behind bars for invading our privacy and inboxes with all that spam. But you know what? The reason the spam gets through is because the internet has so many different ways of communicating information, so many different channels through which it can go. And that's a two-edged sword. That also means that repressive autocratic regimes that would want to keep out and block websites can't keep up with the multiplicity of websites that could be sending the same information. And so that two-edged sword can be used for a gospel purpose as well. We're living in an incredible time. We now have access to information that previous generations could never have imagined. Hugh Hewitt pointed to the Reformation of the 16th century as the model for understanding the transformation of our times. He points out that when Gutenberg invented the movable type press, the cost of producing a book fell 400-fold immediately. 400-fold. A book that cost $400 one day cost a dollar the next. People who could not afford even to look at a book could now have a library in their homes. That's an incredible revolution, and one that we should not misunderstand, because it is the analogy to where we are right now. P.T. Barnum once said not to pick a fight with the press, because he said you ought not to pick a fight with people who buy ink by the barrel. Now you don't even have to buy the ink. All you have to do is have access to a keyboard, access to an internet site, and the next thing you know, the entire world could have access to what you're writing. There's an awful lot of nonsense out there. There are an awful lot of thoughts that never should see the light of day. There are some evil things out there, but there is some incredibly important information. There is information out there that subverts the powers that be, and there's some gospel information that subverts even an entire worldwide conspiracy to deny the truth, to suppress the truth in unrighteousness. As Christians, we need to be aware of the times, the perils, and the opportunities. And I'll be back with some final thoughts about that. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Into the blogosphere we go. That's what's going to be required of us if we're going to be informed in this age and understand what's going on in this media revolution, or reformation, as Hugh Hewitt calls it. It's a big deal, and it's only going to get bigger. 40,000 new blogs a day. That should tell you a whole lot. Finally, we got a caller in Louisville, Kentucky, Matt, listening on WFIA. Matt, what do you think about all this?
Oh, this is great. I really appreciate Hugh and his work with blogging. And Dr. Mueller, I appreciate your commentary. I do have a question for both of you gentlemen. And my question is, a lot has been made about journalistic accountability for the secular arena in the blogosphere. But what do we do about those of us who are Christians who are trying to have a presence with our blogs? What can we do for the sake of biblical accountability and theological accountability? What structures need to be in place so that not just anyone can spout off, you know, something that might not be biblical?
Yeah, you know, Matt, my first thought is that I think the Internet has got pretty much to be self-policing. And this is where I think Christian bloggers should read each other's stuff and jump on each other if you get outside of orthodoxy. In other words, if someone makes a mistake, we need to call them on it. And I see some of that happening. I have to tell you, I think there's some good stuff happening there. Matt, do you have any specific proposal?
Just a lot of dialogue and a lot of comments on people's blogs. Keep people on their toes and keep me on my toes, and everyone that you know who blogs, keep us on our toes.
That's right. Matt, do you have a blog?
I do.
Tell us about it.
It's matthewhall.net, and as a seminarian, it's just a lot of the stuff that I'm working and thinking through, and it's very eclectic. So.
Yeah, well, Matt, I thought this might be you. I've seen your site, and I'd recommend that people go to it. So, you know, good work, and I appreciate the fact you put so much time into kind of laying it all out there for the world to see. And good stuff there, Matt. Appreciate your call today as well.
Thanks, Dr. Mueller.
The need for theological accountability is a good place for us to conclude here, because it is a reminder to us all that we need to be careful consumers of information. Especially as Christians, we have to understand that we are to pursue the good, the beautiful, and the true, whatsoever things are pure, even on the Internet. And as we are looking at claims made, at stories told, at points argued on the Internet, we need to test everything by Scripture. That is the New Testament model. Test it by Scripture. And we need a community of Christian Internet bloggers out there who will hold each other accountable. When we see something written in error, we need to go after it in the spirit of Christian love, but with the determination of Christian truth, we need to call it as it is. And you know what? The darkness needs to fear the light. The light never needs to fear the darkness. The light will win every single time. Mao said, "Let a thousand flowers bloom." Well, that was nonsense, but let's let thousands of bloggers blog. And let's make sure we're there as Christians to get the truth out. I'll be back tomorrow for Ask Anything Wednesday. Get ready with your call. I'll meet you there.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows, Dr. Mueller's daily crosswalk commentary, and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.